You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, celebrities from Bruce Springsteen to Lena Dunham to Kim Kardashian are writing and selling memoirs. A psychologist tells us why we find their stories so fascinating.
First, Wisconsin's voter ID law gets its biggest test so far in November's presidential election.
Supporters of the law, including Governor Walker, have said it will be easy to vote and hard to cheat with the ID system in place. Critics of the law and voting rights advocates are making the case that voter ID will make it harder to vote and could lead to lower turnout, especially for certain categories of voters.
Our next guest is going to try to put that to the test. Working with Dane County, he's going to the polls to see if voter ID laws affect turnout, especially among young voters and minority groups.
Ken Mayer joins us now. He's a professor of political science at the UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Well, we briefly summed it up. Could you talk a little more about the arguments between supporters and critics of voter ID over whether it's really going to affect voter turnout?
The empirical data that has been collected and by researchers in the last few years really does point to reduced turnout, especially among groups that are more marginalized and actually less likely to possess the common forms of ID. And we've established this by looking not just at overall turnout figures, but also in many states you can identify who votes and who doesn't. And in a lot of the litigation that has occurred over the last few years, it's been pretty clear-cut that a significant number of people have been prevented from casting ballots because they lack an ID. And so this study that we'll be doing both in November, based on the November elections, is designed to see if we can identify a little more concretely some of the challenges that voters might face, how easy it was for them to obtain their ID that they used for voting purposes. And we're going to be looking not just at the effects on particular demographic groups, particularly minorities, but the first wave of the study will be focusing exclusively on students, both here at UW-Madison and at UW-Milwaukee.
So you're doing Dane County and looking at students at a couple of campuses. How are you going to try to measure the impact of voter ID on voter turnout?
Well, one of the ways basically these are both surveys, one of which will go to students, and in the second phase of the study, we'll be identifying people who were registered, who are registered voters, but who didn't vote in the November election. And we'll be specifically surveying people who didn't vote and asking questions about the reasons they didn't vote and the degree to which that could have been affected by whether or not they possess one of the forms of ID that they needed to actually cast a ballot.
And you mentioned previous research. Has anybody done this kind of up-close study, especially at a major election like this before?
There was one study that was done in Texas in one congressional district, and the goal of that study was to determine whether the people who thought that they didn't possess an ID that was necessary for them to vote, to see whether they actually might have the identification. And then it produced some results that showed that even people who have one of the qualifying forms of ID frequently believe that they don't. And so there's a significant amount of confusion about whether the law is in effect back in February and even going back into November in 2014 when the law was not in effect. There was some survey data from the Marquette poll that showed that between 20% and 40% of voters actually thought that they were going to have to show an ID. And there's been a lot of movement with some of the court cases and appeals and litigation in Madison, changes in the process of obtaining an ID. So we will be looking to assess the state of knowledge of the ID requirements and what the barriers might be for people who want to vote but ultimately can't.
Talking to elections researcher and political scientist Ken Mayer from UW-Madison, looking at voter ID, its impact on voter turnout. He's researching that in this fall's election. So, Ken, it sounds like you're saying The problem isn't just that some people have trouble getting ID. It's that maybe confusion surrounding the law, maybe a lack of voter education, is in and of itself keeping people from going to the polls.
That could very well be. And this will be one of the things that, we will be looking to identify as whether people who actually could qualify to vote or could cast a ballot don't realize that they have what they need, but misunderstand the requirements or believe that they don't. And so there's a lot of confusion, and among people, among political scientists who study these laws, there's pretty strong consensus that they are not worth the cost, that they really don't prevent any kind of fraud, the type of voter impersonation that they are designed to prevent. Those things just don't happen with any frequency in Wisconsin. And what they do is they, in fact, make it more difficult for people to vote by imposing another requirement, another burden that doesn't actually do anything.
Supposing that voter ID is here to stay at least for a while, are you hoping to learn lessons that might help with voter outreach, voter education from the state, county, local levels?
Well, that's one of the goals that we'll be reporting to the Dane County Clerk and trying to identify ways that they can effectively and efficiently educate people. To see where they might spend whatever money they might have as part of voter outreach and education. Because right now, as far as election administrators go, we're kind of guessing about what it is that you think they need to do. And hopefully, the goal here is to identify some concrete things that they could do to overcome the barriers that people might face.
Now, we have some breaking news. This is reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel via The Nation magazine. They're finding a group was trying to help people register for IDs at different DMV offices, saying, and they have recordings saying they got different advice on each on getting an ID from different offices, often wrong advice, telling people you can't get any sort of ID without a birth certificate. Apparently that is not true. Are you worried that there's confusion out there, even from government offices that are supposed to be issuing IDs, that could lead to poor voter turnout?
Absolutely. This was one of the consequences of the voting rights litigation over the summer that I was actually one of the expert witnesses for, where the federal judge Peterson concluded that the requirements for people to obtain an ID, especially for people who didn't have all of the underlying documents, or the documents like a birth certificate might have trivial spelling errors, and there was case after case, example after example of people who were trying to obtain a driver's license or state ID card and were unable to because they either lacked the documents and couldn't afford to purchase a birth certificate. Several people were not able to locate their birth certificates, and especially people from Chicago and other places were not able to obtain their birth certificate. And so one of the things that Judge Peterson ordered was that the Department of Transportation, the DMV, simplify and ease the procedure so that someone who presents to the DMV without all of the documentation could still get a voter ID or an ID that they could use. And what the Nation article demonstrated is that there still is a lot of confusion, and the decision doesn't appear, based on that article, to have been effectively implemented, because people are still going to the DMV, they're still trying to get their ID, and they're told either that they need a birth certificate or it'll take 6 to 8 weeks to get the ID, which is they won't get it until after the election. And so it's a needlessly complicated process. And again, the frustrating part of this is that it actually doesn't fix anything, that there is no need for voter identification, that the stories of the types of fraud that people claim exist, they're just not true. And they don't take the form of voter impersonation that voter ID will actually prevent. And so it's a burden that voters face for no reason. It just makes it tougher to vote.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison and affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He's going to study the impact of voter ID laws on voter turnout here in Wisconsin in the November elections.
The slew of celebrity memoirs are hitting shelves this fall. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run was released this past week, and it's already a bestseller. Springsteen is hardly the first celebrity to make waves with a memoir. Other big music biographies from the past include Eric Clapton and Patti Smith, and also Life by Keith Richards.
Not just musicians, comedians like Saturday Night Live's Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, other showrunners like Mindy Kaling and Lena Dunham have all got books out. Even celebrities as young as the 23-year-old former One Direction star Zayn Malik have books in the works. People keep buying these celebrity memoirs. What is the attraction?
Regan Gurung joins us now. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Marika.
So what do you think makes celebrity memoirs like Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run so hard to resist for us?
Well, I think in general, there's a simple short answer, which is human nature. I mean, we are curious animals. We are curious beings. And this opportunity to pull back the curtain and see what's really going on, I think, is extremely intoxicating. So on one level, I think it's just this natural curiosity that we have. And I like leading with that, because when I think about why we do anything, I always look at the literature and say, you know, what do we know that we humans do even without learning? And this curiosity is one of those things. Even little babies will spend more time looking at something that is bizarre or unusual. And most celebrities' lives are very, very unusual. So I think babies do it without any training. They're born to do it. And I think as we get older, you know, it just builds on there where we're drawn to it.
I would think part of the reason you read these kind of books is because we're curious, but also maybe to learn some human lessons. You look at someone else's life, you see how maybe they got through a tough time. But on the other hand, these are celebrities. They have so much more money than the rest of us do. In a way, I wonder if they're not that much like the rest of us in a way that might be helpful. So do you think we actually get stuff out of reading these memoirs?
Well, I think there's definitely something to the using them as role models. We try to emulate them in some cases now. Of course, yeah, even in your opening, you mentioned a lot of the celebrity memoirs that, for the most part, we could learn a lot from. If you actually go take a look at the bookshelves, you will see that there are some memoirs that, I'm going to guess, you're probably going to learn what not to do.
And so, Keith Richards?
Exactly. But it's what's really surprising is just the absolute variety of memoirs that are out there. Bruce Springsteen, absolutely. You know, a lot of people go, of course that makes sense. You know, The Boss, look at his long career. But there's just so much out there that I think some have argued that fewer people are buying books. And so what's one way we can actually drive up, you know, and bolster up the publishing industry? Let's do celebrity memoirs. Now, With when you look at the last recent years, it's very clear that attention paid to celebrities has increased. For example, I found a statistic where the number of pages devoted in news publications to celebrities doubled from 1980 to 2000. Doubled. So not just a few more, not a little percent, they actually doubled. In another study, one-third of teens said they spent the majority of their social time gossiping about celebrities. One-third of teens said that. And now when you add to the fact that we have more access to this information, Twitter, blogs, Facebook, the internet, we have more access to this, it's teasing us even more. Automatically you can go, oh, I want to know more, because the more you know, it's social capital. You know, if I know a lot more about a celebrity than you do, I can probably get your attention. I will be rewarded by your attention, and that feels good. So I think there's definitely a component of that, too. Just like the teens gossiping, I think there's a lot of work out there that shows that we want to find out more about topics like this because they provide a common interest for conversation. If I want to get to know you, and I don't know you that well, but both of us know Bruce Springsteen, well, we can talk about Bruce Springsteen. So I think it's a really interesting form of social capital. And the more I know, the more people I can talk to. And, you know, for all those people out there afraid of those times when they're stuck having to talk to somebody, hey, if you can throw out some little statistics about Bruce Springsteen or whoever, you've got a leg up.
Right. I mean, I completely relate to what you're saying. I often click on things that I have, you know, I really have no interest in. Last night I read about the Kardashians' preferred brand of tea. I don't really care about that, but there I am clicking on it. I mean, is there an element of compulsion to this, too, that it's hard not to keep wanting more and more information, no matter how minute that info is?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you use the word compulsion, because some psychologists have actually dug into whether it is a psychological issue of sorts. There's actually a questionnaire out there called the Celebrity Worship Scale. So it's the Celebrity Worship Scale, and work on this started in about the 2000s onwards. And what the researchers found, and a lot of this is coming out of England, what the researchers found is that you can sort of divide people up into three main categories when it comes to information on celebrities. There's the largest chunk is where they make that special effort to follow them just because they like it, you know, and it's satisfying. They have curiosity. There's another chunk where they really want it to build that social capital. And then there's that really small chunk, and the data that I read a study that had about I think 3,000 participants in it. The smallest chunk, 1%, actually are obsessed, where it is this burning compulsion, to use your word, where they have to know more. And I think that's a stepping stone towards stalking and things like that. But the really good news is it's a minute proportion of the people who do pay a lot of attention to celebrities. But I thought that was really interesting that there's even this syndrome out there for celebrity worship.
Well, I really hope that's not me. I did click on the tea thing.
Right. I think a few clicks here and there, and I think you're okay.
We're talking with Regan Gurung right now, the Ben Jay and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And we're talking about the enduring appeal of celebrity memoirs and also just this need to know more about celebrities. And I want to pick up on something else you said, Regan. You said that, in a sense, it sounds like when we buy these celebrity memoirs, we're propping up the book publishing industry. But I wonder, are we supporting the book publishing industry, which is struggling, or are we, you know, just sort of suppressing the sales of everything else, like all of those novels out there that are worthy of reading?
You know, in this particular case, I think it's not that people who buy celebrity memoirs, and when I say people, when you look at the sales figures, it doesn't look like the celebrity memoirs is drawing from any other audiences. It's actually does seem to suggest that here are individuals or there is a group of individuals who may not buy a book, but if there's a celebrity memoir, then they're more likely to buy that. So I think there is that difference there. But what you just said brings up another, I think, pretty critical issue. When I think about celebrity memoirs and why people may read them, I do think that especially in this day and age when we are surrounded by so much negative news, and I'm not even talking about political stuff. I mean, you know, shootings, gun violence, sexual aggression and violence. A celebrity memoir is this escape. Right, you can go into this other life, and of course, depending on the memoir, you still may get some of all of that. But it's an escape, and I think there are a lot of individuals who will use a celebrity memoir for stress relief. Here's this distraction. Here's this other world, and it could either be, I'm glad that's not my world, or wow, what a neat world that is. So many of these celebrity memoirs, I think, provide a form of vicarious living. You know, and a great example, and I think I'm looking forward to maybe checking out Bruce Springsteen, but a lot of the classic rock memoirs, and there was a spate of them that came out over the last few years, and, you know, Aerosmith and Van Halen. I mean, here's this vintage sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And if you're somebody who's never done that or wondered about, ooh, what is that life like? Well, let's pull out Steven Tyler's and see what that life is like, you know?
Yeah. And now you know. Well, so in that case, we get to live vicariously, and there is that element of shelter that you were talking about. It makes us feel kind of safe, and it's a release in a way. But what about for the celebrities themselves? Is it healthy for them to be putting all of this, I guess we assume it's true, but all this personal stuff out for the whole world to read?
Well, you know, to be fair, we don't know how much of what they are putting out is actually true or not. There's probably a good amount of it that is engineered to create buzz and interest and information. But as far as being healthy goes, I think what I find interesting when I've looked into this topic is that a lot of the early celebrity memoirs were these opportunities for the celebrity to take part in a sort of self-therapy. The let's examine myself. Who am I? Let me think about my motivations and so on and so forth. And a lot of the early therapy books were almost therapeutic in a way to say, let's get this stuff out. And, you know, here's this stuff about me. Here's this opportunity to talk about me. And maybe by doing that, I'll have a sense of understanding what I've been doing a little better. So there is a little bit of that. But when it comes down to is it healthy or not, right now, social media, books, especially for celebrities, so much is driven by this notion of let's get some publicity. And many, many folks have argued that celebrities are write memoirs at that point. And again, I don't think this is Bruce Springsteen necessarily, but I think some celebrities, when their careers have, to use that phrase, jumped the shark or are on the downward spiral, that's the time to put out the memoir because we can pump up some sales. So I think celebrities, not just in the paychecks, but I think just in terms of how much more visibility it gives them, they're benefiting a lot from getting those memoirs out there.
Regan, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
You bet.
That was Regan Gurung. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And he was with us there to talk about the enduring appeal of celebrity memoirs.
And you can watch from my memoir at a bookstore near you, exposing the seamy underbelly of actual celebrity memoirs. Right now, House Speaker Paul Ryan said this morning that he will work with whoever wins the presidential race in November. But political observers see him in an increasingly difficult position, one that may just become harder under the next president, whether that president's named Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
The Republican Party in general is facing a similar problem. While some are on board with Trump's ideas, other conservatives are still holding out on supporting his agenda.
Their position has become even more difficult this week after a handful of prominent conservative newspapers endorsed Hillary Clinton, most recently the Arizona Republic. It was the first time that paper endorsed a Democratic candidate in over 100 years.
Rachel Bay joins us now. She covers House leadership for Politico. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on air.
Well, the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, this morning pledged to, this is a quote, work with whoever wins whatever office. So given that, though, how might the next 4 years look under Trump presidency? We'll start there for both Paul Ryan and for the GOP in general.
Well, see, if you got a Trump president, basically Paul Ryan leading House Republicans, he's going to have to become, you know, the person in the party that keeps Trump in check. Now, a lot of Republicans privately will tell you that they don't feel like Trump is an authentic Republican, right? I mean, he has some wild card positions that definitely go against the conservative brand, things that Paul Ryan himself supports. Like, for instance, in this debate, we saw him back the idea of no-fly, no-buy, which is a Democrat position that if you're on the no-fly list, you're not allowed to buy a gun. He also is not a big supporter of free trade. He in the past has backed minimum wage hikes, and he has flip-flop on abortion. Basically, he becomes president, and Paul Ryan's position then is to make sure that anything that's, you know, going through Congress and being signed into law by the president is authentically conservative. So he's in this awkward position where he, you know, wants to advance conservative values, but will be working with a president who, let's face it, is not like him.
Well, not only that, but they have this sort of difficult personal relationship between them. Ryan held out for quite a while before he decided he would support Donald Trump. He went on retreat for a while and did some soul searching, and all of that was very public. Now he supports Trump, but I can't imagine that Donald Trump would forget all of that.
Oh, no, and we've definitely seen that he hasn't. Remember when Ryan was running in his own primary, he had sort of a mini Donald Trump in his own backyard, someone very espousing a lot of the same values, Paul Nehlen, if you recall. And Donald Trump, you know, tweeted at Paul Nehlen, sort of flirted with him online the idea of backing him, and then told the Washington Post, I'm not ready to endorse Paul Ryan, just a couple of days before Ryan's primary. Now, obviously, Ryan came out way victorious in that, easily defeated his challenger. But yeah, it was just another awkward moment to show these guys are totally different men, both policy and stylistically. Seeing them work together in the future could be very interesting.
And on the other hand, Ryan has said he would work with Hillary Clinton if she wins. Apparently, he's only met her a couple of times so far in his life. So how would that likely shake out?
Yeah, so he's going to, if Clinton is in the White House, he's going to basically have to make a decision. Does he want to try to get some things passed and work with the Democratic president to try to get things like criminal justice reform done, tax reform, maybe something on immigration to sort of, you know, get something big accomplished so he can talk about it in the future if he decides to run for president. But if he does that, he's got this increasingly conservative conference that next year is going to be even more conservative. They don't want to work with Hillary Clinton. You know, I talked to the leader of this group called the Freedom Caucus that has been a pain in Ryan's side. Basically, nothing is conservative enough for him, for them. So they keep rejecting some ideas that the speaker would like to pursue, like, for instance, passing a budget, because they didn't think it was conservative enough. So if he decides to work with Clinton and try to get something done, he's going to have to watch out for conservatives in his conference that might totally balk and, you know, kick and scream, refuse to back it. And then, you know, he's just going to, you have another, you know, John Boehner 2.0 situation, you know, where John Boehner was negotiating too much, his conference didn't like it, and they ended up running him out of town.
Well, and then I suppose, no matter who wins the White House, you may have a strand of in the Conservative Party, in the GOP, who might still be loyal to some of Trump's agenda, who represent maybe a more alternative version of the GOP. And then you have Paul Ryan, who represents the traditional version of the GOP, the establishment. Could those two end up coming head to head?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one thing that we heard Ryan talk about this week, and it definitely created some chatter here in Washington, was he basically said he wouldn't rule out running for president someday when talking to someone at an economic forum. And he used to say, you know, no, I'm focused on being speaker. I'm focused on being speaker. But instead he said, you never say never to, you know, running for president. And basically, if he does that, he's going to be torn between those two things you were just talking about. You know, when you are running for president, you cater to your base. You, you know, you talk about red meat issues, and you take a really hard line to sort of win that nomination so you can become, you know, the leader of your party or try to take the White House. But when you're speaker, you have to be pragmatic. You got to keep the lights on, the government running. That means passing sometimes, you know, things that don't your party might not like. You got to work for Democrats and divided government. Got to make sure the country doesn't default on its debt, and that means compromise. And so that's the exact opposite path that a lot of conservatives or, you know, Trump supporters, anti-establishment types, would want him to take. So those two things, you know, allies of Paul Ryan have told me they don't know how he's going to do it, but, you know, it's going to be tough. If he wants to run for the White House someday and he wants to be speaker, he's got his work cut out for him.
We're talking with Politico's Rachel Bade right now. She covers House leadership. And we're talking about the political future of House Speaker Paul Ryan. Also looking at the GOP in general, Paul Ryan faces a difficult road, it sounds like, whether we're talking about a presidency with Donald Trump or a presidency with Hillary Clinton. And at a forum earlier today, Paul Ryan indicated that, you know, maybe he would not turn aside a look at running for the White House. But on the other hand, he's also said it wasn't necessarily something he needs. He wants to get his agenda through. He doesn't necessarily need to be president. But what is the through path if he does decide to run for president?
Well, that's the big question mark, because in the entire history of the country, there's never been somebody who has run the House as Speaker and then, you know, won the White House. They're two totally opposite jobs, two totally different roads. I think what we're going to see Speaker Ryan do is he's trying to build sort of, there's this feeling out there amongst Republicans that for the past 8 years they've been sort of the party of no. You know, they've gone against Obamacare. They don't want Obamacare. They didn't want, there's a whole bunch of things that the president has done that they've been against, right? Paul Ryan is trying to change the party to one of vision and saying, we have our own ideas that we want to enact. It's not just no to everything. We have our own ideas to make the country better. And so what we're going to see him do as Speaker, and we'll see if, you know, the Republican Party sort of goes with this, but, like, he's going to be putting forward an agenda. He talks about it all the time, holds up his Better Way agenda, and basically a whole bunch of policy proposals, conservative policy proposals, and he's going to try to make the party one pushing for a certain goal, for certain changes in law. And by doing that, you know, hoping to get more support from conservatives to show that he, you know, he can be supportive of conservatives, but also be for something.
And again, if Donald Trump is in the White House, if Donald Trump is not in the White House, how much sway do you expect Donald Trump, the figure himself, to have over what happens? I mean, obviously a lot less than if he's the president of the United States, but these figures that run for office, they don't immediately fade away. There's someone there who is now a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I think it definitely says something that Republicans picked him to be their nominee. Now, I do think that there are a lot of Republicans who are having some buyer's remorse. And depending on how, you know, the election turns out, how the next few weeks go, you know, if it ends up being a huge catastrophe, I think you could see the Republican Party, you know, running in the opposite direction of him. But you do still have a lot of people in the Republican Party right now, a certain faction that feel like him. You know, they're sort of they're sick of trade deals, which is typically something that Republicans are for. You know, he has some policy visions that, you know, typically the Republican Party is not talking about. So I think it really is going to depend on how the next month goes. You know, one issue with trade, you know, everybody's wondering, are they going to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP? And that, depending on how Trump does and depending on how people feel, you know, in the lame duck or going into next year, they could do something with TPP to work with Democrats on it. But if there's still this sort of Trump phenomenon going on, they probably won't be able to do it. And that's definitely going to affect, you know, what Paul Ryan can do on trade. Absolutely.
We're talking about the political future of House Speaker Paul Ryan right now and the GOP in general. Rachel Bate is with us. She covers House leadership for Politico.
We'd like you to join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you see ahead for the Republican Party and for Paul Ryan in particular under a Trump presidency, under a Clinton presidency? Are you a Republican who's having doubts about the party in this Trump era? And are your doubts on Trump himself or the party establishment? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our discussion about the future of the GOP under either a Clinton or a Trump presidency.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. How do you see things going over the next 4 years for Republicans, for Paul Ryan? If there's a Trump election victory, if there's a Clinton election victory, do you think the Republican Party needs an overhaul, some revisiting to iron out the difficulties between the Donald Trump faction and the older established faction? Call 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Rachel Bate stays with us. She is a political reporter who covers House leadership. And we'll go to our first caller now. We have Marsha with us in Prairie du Sac. Marsha, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment because I think Paul Ryan is so respected and would have been such a good candidate for president. But I do want to point out the fact that both the House and the Senate have majority of Republicans. So I think that really reflects how this country is going to look at this next election.
And can you flesh that out a little, Marsha? What do you think that says about the next election?
I think the jury's still out. I know that there's many, many people from the first debate who feel that Hillary certainly has taken a huge step, and I think polls show that. But I think there's just this silent group of people who voted in their senators and their representatives, and it was done very quietly, and that really could affect and make the Trump group show up at the poll.
Oh, okay, well, thank you, Marsha. And Rachel, what do you think of that?
She's talking about, you know, people voting for House and Senate lawmakers separately a little from the president. I mean, this is something that I'm watching personally as someone who covers Congress. I'm curious how it's going to affect both the majorities. Right now, Republicans control both chambers. There's some worry that, you know, if Trump says something controversial, like, you know, he did about the Muslim family that lost their son in Iraq, that, you know, this is going to have a blowback on their majorities, and that's going to affect the way they govern. If you have Clinton in the White House and you don't have, you know, a check over here, over in Congress with Republicans, you know, that's something that a lot of conservatives, even who don't like Trump, would never want to see. So, I mean, this is something that's being talked about in the Republican Party. Can they turn out Republicans who will keep the majorities in the House and the Senate, even if they're not so excited to vote about Trump, vote for Trump? And even if Clinton wins, that's something, you know, we're watching on a daily basis. Right now, they do seem to be doing pretty well. Trump has sort of stabilized in the past month, such that we think Republicans can keep both chambers, even if Clinton wins. But the question is, you know, what does Trump say next, and how could that affect down ballot?
And looking at, you know, a possible Trump presidency, are there issues that you think Paul Ryan would be likely to work with Donald Trump on, and there would be some mutual agreement there on moving something forward?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, Trump talks a lot about the country, the spending of the country, and basically, you know, trying to get the country's fiscal house in order. That's a talking point we hear from Republicans all the time. So I do think you could see them work together on some sort of entitlement reforms. That, of course, would depend on Democrats. Do they have control of the Senate? They would absolutely block something of that magnitude. You could potentially see them work together on some sort of corporate tax reform. Donald Trump knows the business world through and through, obviously, being a real estate tycoon himself, and Paul Ryan, being former Ways and Means chairman, really cares about tax reform. We've heard him talk about it a lot. So could we see them do something on that? Absolutely.
Let's take another call here. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just appreciate your two comments. Is that I'm befuddled as to how the Republican primary electorate elected Donald Trump, because this is a change election, and had the Republicans nominated any other of their almost any other of their candidates, they would be beating Hillary Clinton handily. I guess that's my comment, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Jim, and this is a question that's been decided already, but Rachel, what do you say to Jim?
Yeah, so I personally also wondered that, you know, what if Paul Ryan would have won? Could he have, you know, been the nominee instead of Donald Trump? I think it's a great question. I'm not sure the answer. I think that right now we see this sort of anti-establishment wave pulsing through the nation. And I mean, Paul Ryan is very conservative, don't get me wrong, but as the person who leads the House, you know, that doesn't always help you with this crowd that I'm talking about right now that is backing Donald Trump. So I guess, you know, it's, you have so many, you know, Republican candidates running for president. Maybe it was because, you know, there were so many people were sort of divided. They weren't rallying around someone other than Trump, you know, so the person who had the most votes ended up, you know, it wasn't clear until, what, late spring that he was going to be the nominee, and probably because we saw so many people run and we didn't see the Republican Party get behind someone early. So had Paul Ryan decided to run, thrown his, you know, hat into the ring much earlier, could it have been different? I'm not sure. I guess we're going to just have to wait until 2020 and see if he decides to do that and if you get a totally different race.
Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Rachel Bates. She covers House leadership for Politico.